This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates, and watch us on Free Speech TV, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. President-elect Donald Trump had promised to, quote, drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. when he was running for president. The man, who probably never expected to actually win the election, then promptly went on to fill his transition team with corporate lobbyists of the type he had earlier decided were part of the problem. After coming under criticism for violating his own promises, Trump promptly turned around and banned all lobbyists from the White House, creating a mass panic in D.C. Among the people now being touted for Treasury Secretary is Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, and one that was deeply enmeshed in the mortgage crisis. Does a billionaire like Donald Trump even know how to set economic policy that will benefit ordinary Americans, especially given his lofty promises of making all his supporters' dreams come true? Joining me to help answer that is my guest, Doug Henwood. He is a political economist, editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. And he's also a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, Doug.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about the lobbyists issue before we turn to Jamie Dimon. It seems kind of bizarre that Trump would first fill his team with lobbyists and then completely empty them. Did he not realize what he was doing initially? And does he have any idea what he's doing now by having a blanket ban?
I don't think he has any idea what he's doing, period. It's just a remarkable display so far. The guy throughout the campaign made it very clear that he didn't know very much. He seemed to view the whole campaign as just a strutting exercise in narcissism. As you said in the intro, I don't think he ever expected to win. He certainly hasn't looked terribly happy in the few pictures I've seen of him since his victory. He seems way out of his depth. He's a showman and a huckster, and not somebody who can govern. So, you know, his first instinct is to surround himself with the kinds of people he feels comfortable with, you know, rich people and the people who work for them. And then when he gets a criticism, he does something impetuous and reverses it all. There have been just all kinds of turmoil with the transition team all along. But all looks, you know, like it's going to be a circus. And I imagine that's what his presidency will be like. Although it will be a circus probably featuring a large cast of ghouls like Rudy Giuliani and Ted Cruz and people like that. But, you know, I also want to be careful about overdoing the sense that this transition is a circus, because, you know, everyone ever underestimated him throughout the primary and general election. And here he is, our president-elect, which is just still a phrase that is very difficult to pronounce. So Who knows what's going to emerge out of this. But, you know, I suppose we shouldn't underestimate the guy, but it really does look like what the Italians call a total casino, total madhouse.
Now, of course, the idea of banning lobbyists from being part of a transition team, in theory, is something the left should embrace, right? I mean, maybe it's something that we might have liked to have seen done in a little bit more organized manner. How will this play out in Washington, D.C.? I mean, most of the people who live in and around the White House, who aren't, you know, in the service industry or actually elected officials themselves, or work for elected officials, are lobbyists. I mean, if you shake the city, you'll have 100 million lobbyists drop out of them. Maybe not that many. So what's going to happen to all of these people? Are they panicking?
Well, it's the basis in which Washington runs. You spend a few years in government service, go be a lobbyist and cash in on your connections, maybe go back to work to refresh your connections, then back to work in government, refresh your connections, and then go back to K Street. It just seems like, you know, the classic revolving door, and it's going to be hard to run Washington without that kind of revolving door in operation.
Right. I mean, Trump has to hire something like 4,000 people before his presidency begins. Can he even do that without, hiring lobbyists? And who's going to determine who a lobbyist is and who, you know, if one person is or isn't a lobbyist? It's going to be pretty hard for them to figure that out.
Yeah, the whole thing is a total mess, you know. And I think he seemed to have been surprised by the number of people he has to hire, the number of appointees, even this, you know, the size of the staff in the White House. The guy just has no idea what he's doing, and he's going to need guides to how Washington works, of course. And this will begin, you know, the socialization process of turning him into a good standing member of the establishment, I presume. I remember when Jimmy Carter came to Washington, he was going to run, you know, the city on outsiders, and was quickly overrun by them because, you know, they know the lay of the land and he didn't. And I think you're going to see something similar with Trump. He doesn't know the lay of the land. So he's going to surround himself with some, you know, very experienced right-wing Republican politicians, and he's going to have some kind of lobbyists, or it's just not going to work. There's not going to be anybody to work in the administration. And one of those striking things about Congress, just kind of related point, is that they pay the staff so poorly that nobody can stay there for more than a few years. So that's why one of the reasons the whole lobbying mill gets filled is that civil servants are not paid very well. So you just spend a couple of years doing your thing on some staff or other, and then cash in by going over to K Street. And it's just part of the way the whole thing is structured. It's not like we have the kind of professional civil service that they do in Britain that you know, has some degree of institutional continuity. We have so many political appointees, and Trump, you know, is going to have to fill all those thousands of posts with, I presume, the usual suspects.
I'm thinking of the very well-known British TV show Yes Minister. Which I highly recommend, by the way, for anybody. It certainly applies to American government as well, I'm sure. What about this idea that Treasury Secretary under Trump would be a one Jamie Dimon? I mean, this is the ultimate insider. This is the ultimate big banks representative in the White House. How could this be okay with the millions of people that voted for Trump, who are, you know, basically assuming their personal finances are going to improve within the next 4 years?
Well, you know, being mentioned alongside him is this guy, Steven Mnuchin, who is his finance chair during his campaign, Goldman Sachs alum, champion foreclosure artist.
I mean, these would have been some of the same people President Hillary Clinton might have picked, right?
Well, not Mnuchin, because I think he's pretty right-wing, but certainly Dimon. Yeah. There was a lot of talk about Dimon being Hillary's Treasury Secretary as well. You know, this is the ultimate insider, the ultimate establishment guy. Dimon yesterday was reluctant to do it. Today, I don't know, now they're saying he's not so reluctant. It's very often hard to turn down the president if a president asks you to do something, and Dimon may find himself in that position. But it's just, you know, Steve Bannon, you know, the white supremacist creep, is also a Goldman alum. So, you know, if we get Mnuchin, we'd have two Goldman alums. If we get Dimon, we'll have Goldman and JP Morgan Chase. But it is very much the heart of the establishment, which, by the way, Trump was really never part of. Wall Street really never liked him, partly for political and temperamental reasons, but also because he didn't pay his debts. And he was not part of the inside circle in New York City real estate either. So this guy, you know, is kind of an outsider to the plutocrat class, but he's now seems to be surrounding himself with the requisite number of insiders, so he's taken seriously. It's been striking, too, to watch how all these political professionals, the Republican establishment and the corporate establishment, had just, you know, like 2 weeks ago pronounced Trump, you know, the equivalent of the bubonic plague. And here they are, you know, like falling all over themselves to get jobs. And now he's going to bribe the plutocrat with deregulation and tax cuts, and they're going to come around too. So it's amazing how he's gone from this frightening outsider, and you know, now we're seeing even some Democrats talking about working with him, you know, this frightening outsider who reminded people of Hitler, and now he's somebody we can work with.
It's right. It's amazing talk of what unity and peaceful transition has some of us quite worried. Now, what about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? That was one issue on which not only did Trump actually really strike a chord among ordinary Americans, but he was able to point to Hillary Clinton, who was late to the game in denouncing the TPP, probably because of the pressure put on by Bernie Sanders. He was able to, in one of the debates, remind her that she had called the TPP the gold standard for free trade agreements. Is this one place where Clinton and Trump really differed? But will Trump actually be able to keep his promise on the TPP?
It seems barring some kind of, you know, Lazarus-like miracle, it seems dead, that there's just no support for it left anymore. The Republicans, at least Trump and some of the Republican delegation, and enough of the Democrats are hostile to the idea. I suppose Obama could try to ram it through in this lame duck session, but that would be politically pretty smelly.
Right. I mean, there was some talk actually of doing that in the days after the election. All I could think of was, really, did this election not, teach you the right lesson? I mean, the whole point, a big part of the election was a rejection of the Democrat support for things like TPP, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, Hillary was initially for it, as we all know, and then in Mark Landler's book on the relationship between Hillary and Obama, he reports an incident where the Obama's aides told him that Hillary had just come out against the TPP, and all Obama did was roll his eyes. I think he knew it was just a campaign ruse, and he was familiar with those things and Hillary's use of those things. So it certainly would have been revived had she been elected president, but I don't know, Trump really made that a big issue. It'd be really quite a reversal for him to turn around on that one. And, you know, I think, you know, people look at trade agreements as the cause of so many of our economic woes. I think, you know, the causes are much more complex than that. But, it's symbolic and richly symbolic, especially to a lot of the people in Midwest who might have voted for a more populist economic message had Hillary been a credible messenger of one. The TPP and NAFTA and all that is just radioactive to people in the industrial Midwest. And that is why Trump was able to carry so many of those states when Hillary should have won them.
Right. TPP, of course, being the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this free trade agreement, massive free trade agreement that the Democrats had been championing. And this is the sort of thing, this sort of neoliberal economic model that began, that the Democrats embraced, rather, starting with Bill Clinton, and just didn't, listen to their own constituency either, and even organized labor in pushing these free trade agreements forward. Let's turn to how much of what ended up playing out on election night was Clintonian hubris and arrogance. Doug, I remember reading a report about how some of the Democratic campaigns in the Rust Belt in the weeks and months before the election were struggling financially. They really didn't have enough money to do the kind of campaigning that they needed to do. These places where Clinton lost by just a few thousands of votes, and the Clinton campaign just basically shrugged it off because they just assumed she would win.
Yeah, it's remarkable, their arrogance. There's also that story by Becky Bond and Zach Exley, that two former Sanders staffers, who claim that as much as 25 or 30% of the voters that the Clinton Get Out the Vote operation turned out were actually Trump voters, not because they hadn't really talked to these people. They hadn't knocked on doors or called them on the phone and written their names down and, you know, held them in mind for election day. No, these were like all identified through big databases. All their high-tech operation, they were targeting these people. And it was also a similar error in their targeting these Midwestern industrial states. They were using these big data schemes rather than more on-the-ground traditional kinds of analyses. And it turned around and bit them in a very unpleasant place. The hubris was just remarkable. And this was a campaign that had raised something like $1 billion. That was staffed by, you know, the premier campaign professionals in the toll trade. And they nonetheless came up with this, this empty, messageless campaign that just waffled all over the place from week to week. But, you know, where you thought they were on top of things, just in this level of technical competence, you thought they would at least have that down, even if they had no passion or political philosophy behind them. But that didn't even work. It was just a total Keystone Cops episode, the way they ran that campaign, behind this facade of organization and discipline. It was a remarkable failure.
And Doug, you were among those people who had been criticizing Hillary Clinton, from a very sort of principled way for a very long time, criticizing her from the left, and you came under a lot of pressure and also a lot of attacks for doing so by liberals in the wake of the election. Have you, like some other people I've seen, been accused of helping Trump win because you criticized Hillary so much?
Oh, absolutely. I've gotten all kinds of things. I mean, this this fellow, Tom Watson, who ran the Hillary Men or something like that, just accused me of being overjoyed now that my candidate won. I was just like, you know, I think Trump is an appalling, horrifying character. And it's just, that's just one example of a lot of this sort of abuse I've gotten, mostly on social media. Nobody's come like, you know, making threatening phone calls or, you know, knocking on my door or anything like that. But what I said from the first, you know, even bracketing my political objections, when I talked to liberals who really didn't have that much of a political difference with her, but I said, you know, even bracketing my political objections, she's a terrible candidate. She's just got all these scandals. People don't like her. The scandals could blow up at any time. She's a terrible campaigner. You really may regret putting all your money behind this one candidate. And everyone, when I said that, starting in the middle of 2014, when I started doing my work in Hillary, I was relentlessly attacked for misogyny, for secret republicanism, for all manner of offenses. And you know, I turned out to be right. And there's a certain satisfaction. I believe Gore Vidal said the four most beautiful words in English were, "I told you so." You know, the satisfaction is highly mixed right now because, you know, the payoff is Donald Trump as president, which is horrifying. Yeah. But, you know, I thought that people were making a terrible mistake by getting behind her in the first place.
I mean, you were trying to warn people. You were trying to warn people, not wish Trump
on us. I was trying
Trump
to warn
us.
Them, and now, you know, they want to shoot the messenger after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, we had never on this program let her, the Clintons, off the hook. And then by extension, Doug, the other problem was that Barack Obama's presidency has been problematic. I mean, there are a lot of really angry and upset people right now. There is a mass trauma, particularly in cities where there's a huge turnout and vote for Hillary Clinton. But there are a lot of people who sort of politicized for the first time or angry for the first time. And my question to those people who are really upset about Trump, but who would have been just fine with a Clinton presidency, is when unarmed black folks were being killed by police departments all over the country and nothing was being done about it, when President Obama was drone bombing people all over the world and nobody was saying anything about it, when President Obama was deporting millions of immigrants, we were all okay. We, as in the liberal elites, quote unquote, were okay with that. And, you know, I mean, this does not, it's not a good thing for the left if that's what the left was doing. Of course, there's many factions within the left. And I'm proud to say, I think that you and I did criticize Obama and Clinton, and we should have, and we should continue to do that.
Oh, you know, absolutely. But, you know, when you can speak in elegant, complete sentences spontaneously off the top of your head, you're evidently, you know, obviously an extremely well-read and sophisticated guy like Obama. I wouldn't say quite the same of Hillary, but, you know, she is extremely competent, intelligent, you know, on top of things. When you have people like that,
they seem very presidential, don't they?
Well, yeah, but they also fit in with the mores of the professional managerial class. They have the style that appeals to them. Trump is a Bulgarian. You know, Spy magazine back in the 80s used to call him a short-fingered Bulgarian, which is accurate if cruel. But you know, there is this issue of style and partisanship, so that, you know, Obama and Clinton can get away with things that Republicans can't get away with. You know, and you mentioned earlier NAFTA. I don't think George Bush would have been able to pass NAFTA. It took Bill Clinton to pass NAFTA. It would have taken Hillary Clinton, I think, to privatize or, you know, limit Social Security. If the Republicans try to do that, it would be much more of a firestorm. But it's amazing what Democrats can get away with and either be ignored or praised. As some Trump supporters said a few months ago, Hillary voted for a 700-mile wall, a fence, rather, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Trump famously wanted a 1,000-mile wall, but as this guy said, for 300 miles, he's Hitler. You know, this
that's a good people point.
They will excuse anything that a Democrat does. You know, even though a Republican, you know,
and this
when a Republican does it, it's terrible. But right. When a Democrat does it, it's acceptable.
And now the Democrats aren't going to be able to get away with it because they have no control of the presidency or either of the chambers of Congress, and likely will lose control of or any kind of political sway over the Supreme Court as well.
But also the states, you know, like now two-thirds of the states are entirely Republican hands. I believe they're one state house away from being able to pass constitutional amendments without obstruction. It's been a total disaster for the party at the lower level. Yet all these Democrats are saying during the campaign, Republicans are in meltdown. No, they're not. their party's in meltdown.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, Doug, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where's the best place for people to be able to find your work and follow you?
Well, there's my little blog, which I don't update that often, lbo-news.com. Also, Twitter, very active on there.
What's your Twitter handle?
Doug Henwood.
We'll post a link to that later today. Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Doug Henwood is a political economist and editor of Left Business Observer, author of After the New Economy, as well as My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. By the way, if you missed our interview with Senator Bernie Sanders earlier this week, visit us online at risingupwithsonali.com to hear it. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at facebook.com/ruwithsonali and find us on other social media as well.